and welcome to the Triathlon Coach Podcast. My name's Simon Ward and I'm your host for this weekly show where my goal is to share practical, usable advice from the best athletes, coaches and experts from the world of triathlon so that you can get the most from your training time and maximise your enjoyment of the triathlon lifestyle. If you don't already know me, I'm the founder of thetriathloncoach.com and the SWAT Inner Circle, and I've been a triathlon coach for over 20 years, working with absolute beginners right up to Olympic athletes and coaching them to race at distances from sprint through to Ironman. Reviews and ratings are the currency of podcasts, so if you enjoy today's conversation, I'd really appreciate it if you could drop into iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher and leave a rating and a review. And while you're there, please subscribe to our weekly episodes so that they can be downloaded straight into your phone or your iPad or wherever you choose to listen to them. And finally, to say thank you, I have a free gift for you. I've put together 25 of my top tips amassed from 30 years of racing and training and coaching in the sport. All you have to do is email triathlonsuccess to beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she'll send it right out to you. Okay, now it's time to crack on with today's guest. Hey, welcome back, listeners. Simon Ward here again, your host on this regular weekly podcast, bringing you some amazing guests and none more so than the man who's joining me today, Mr. Eric Tozer. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, Simon.
So let me tell you a little bit about Eric. And Eric, please correct me if I get anything wrong here. Eric has what's known as type 1 diabetes. We'll dive into that in a little bit. But he was diagnosed not at childbirth or in his early years, but at the age of 22. So, you know, as a young adult, and which is unusual in itself. But he's not let that stop him. And we're going to really touch on some of his athletic achievements. But if I can tell you that Eric has run half marathons, he's run full marathons, he's done sprint and Olympic distance triathlons, 70.3, full Ironman events. He's also run across America, right? That's over 3,000 miles. And he's completed recently the World Marathon Challenge, which is just a bonkers event for anybody. regardless of whether you're challenged by diabetes. So I really want to get into that later. But Eric's also the co-founder of the Diabetes Sports Project. So if you have diabetes, if you have friends or family members with it, or if you know somebody, then please listen into this and let them know about this podcast because it's going to blow your mind. So Eric, let's start off right at the beginning. Looking through your website here, you were diagnosed with type 1 diabetes in 2006. Now, you were telling me before that, and I have a friend who's a triathlete who has type 1 diabetes, and he's been involved in the sport for 30 years. And I always thought this was known as juvenile diabetes because it was diagnosed quite young. But so that's why I said that it was unusual for you to be diagnosed at 22.
Yeah. And you know, when I was diagnosed, I didn't have any family history of it. I didn't know there was type 1 and type 2. I was very naive to the whole situation and didn't really know anything about it. And yeah, you're exactly right. We kind of used to call it juvenile diabetes because they thought, and kind of the general thought was that only kids were diagnosed with it. They've since realized that, you know, a significant portion of the, and I know in America, it's about 1.3 million. But the people with type 1 can be diagnosed into their teens, 20s, 30s, 40s, and so on. So it's now just referred to sort of as type 1 diabetes. Some people do still call it juvenile, but yeah, now it's type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes, and they're vastly different amongst those two. Type 1, our pancreas is essentially turned off. It doesn't release any insulin, and insulin is you need insulin to stay alive, and it's essentially, you know, without getting too scientific, it delivers the glucose from your food into your cells for energy. So without that insulin delivery, then our bodies don't function.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but type 1 diabetes is more genetic. You're born with it, although you may not show the symptoms until later on. Type 2 diabetes is more lifestyle instigated and comes as a result of, I suppose, many years of having poor nutrition and a stressful lifestyle.
That's correct. You know, And it's you know, it's unfortunate to see, but then, you know, with type two, it can be reversed, right? Typically, as you noted, it's more of a lifestyle, kind of unhealthy diet and exercise or some combination. It can be genetic as well. So, you know, with type one, it is typically, I guess we'll say typically genetic. For me, it wasn't. It was a sort of more that autoimmune response because it's an autoimmune disease. So I, at some point, got sick and my body essentially mistakenly fought off my pancreas and kind of shut it down instead of fighting off whatever the infection was or the virus was that I actually had. So essentially my body gave it to itself. And with type one, it's, you have to know what your blood sugar is all day long. So, you know, historically that was pricking your finger as many times as possible. Now with devices like a Dexcom, you know, I get a reading on my phone every 5 minutes with what my blood sugar is and a trending arrow of where it's headed. And I can set alarms. So if it goes too high or too low, it will alert me real time. So whether I'm asleep or if I'm out on the bike or jumping in the pool or whatever it is, headed into a meeting, I can see where my blood sugar is going so I can get ahead of those highs and lows and really just live my quality of life goes way up. And, you know, it's just a tremendous device and really changing the diabetes world. But yeah, it's 24 hours a day kind of being on top of your mind.
So I guess 2006 was when you were diagnosed with this. I see that you, from your website, you were traveling in Europe. So maybe the traveling, the time zone changes, you know, being a young man there. Had you just passed out or graduated from college there? And so you're probably going on what they call a gap year and living the dream. So maybe not looking after yourself as effectively as you would normally.
Yeah, you know, it was a short trip, actually. I was, I just graduated college. I captained the soccer team in college for a couple of years and, just coming off of that. And, you know, I've always lived a pretty healthy lifestyle and, stayed pretty fit and have a relatively healthy diet. I do have a bit of a sweet tooth, but, it actually traveled over to Europe and for a couple of reasons, but my now wife was over there and studying and a mate and I wanted to go see the end of the World Cup. So we went over to Germany and didn't actually get to go to any games, but just being there and, you know, with all the fans was pretty, pretty special. And so it was during those 2 weeks that I had classic symptoms. I didn't know that there were symptoms. I didn't even know anything was wrong, but I lost 20 pounds in 2 weeks. I was eating and drinking nonstop because my body wasn't getting the nutrients because my pancreas wasn't releasing insulin. So I felt thirsty all the time. Your body's natural way to try to kind of flush that blood sugar out essentially is to drink a lot of water and then you have to go pee. So that was happening but I was completely naive. You know, I thought, you know, I'm sure I'm losing all this weight because of all the beers and croissants over here. but when I got back to America, it was a pretty easy diagnosis. And I, a week later, started my career. So I, you know, moved across the country, living by myself and then, you know, starting my job out of school and having to kind of figure out what the heck this type one diabetes thing was all about. But, I distinctly remember, and I really credit being an athlete and being a competitor to what happened next. So I was on the phone with the doctor. I remember where I was, what I was wearing. And he's like, you know, you have type one diabetes. And maybe I was naive, but, you know, I took this mindset that, okay, well, what do I need to do to control this thing that I don't really know much about yet? What do I need to do to control it and live the life that I want to live as opposed to let it control me and let it dictate what I can or can't do? Back in 2006, you know, I didn't really know anybody with type one. I didn't know what it meant or what it didn't mean. You mentioned you have a friend who's done triathlon for 30 years. You know, I didn't know people like that. So I didn't know what was possible. So, it could have been me being a little bit naive but that was my outlook on it. That sort of competitive mindset. I wasn't going to let this thing beat me or tell me what I could or couldn't do.
let's just talk about the challenges of having type 1 diabetes then for somebody who doesn't engage in athletic pursuits. So you mentioned a little bit about having to monitor your blood sugar constantly. If you were living what's considered to be a normal, you know, a normal life, a non-endurance athlete life, how would you monitor and respond to those challenges on a daily basis in terms of insulin supplementation? And then let's then dive into what are the challenges when you add some athletic pursuits to that?
Yeah. There are challenges, but there's challenges whether you're active or not with type 1. The very harsh and scary reality is that people die all the time from type 1. It's a terrible disease. It's not a really sexy disease, right? Because you look at me, you know, somebody passes by me on the street and they don't feel sorry for me. I don't look sick. I don't think. So, you know, it kind of doesn't get that attention, but it is a terribly tragic disease and kids, adults. I mean, you know, I have people in my life that have passed away from it. So the complications are incredibly grave and serious. You know, having an overnight low blood sugar is every parent who has a type 1 child, whether they're 2 years old or 20 years old or 40 years old, that's the fear, is that you don't wake up. You know, and it's a kind of the harsh reality we live in. But, you know, again, the technology has gotten so much better that things like that are, you know, hopefully less likely to happen, but the reality is still there. With or without exercise, you need to know what your blood sugar is all the time. So the more readings you get, the better. So if you are on finger sticks, you know, the more you poke your finger and draw blood to get that reading, the better. That's gets into sort of a whole conversation around the cost of insulin and the cost of test strips and the cost of diabetes. And it can be a very expensive disease. The device that I wear, the Dexcom, it's the equivalent of doing 288 finger sticks every day. So for me, it's been a great educational tool because, you know, if I'm on the bike trainer, I can sit there and watch my blood sugars change real time. I can see the impact of exercise, see the impact of, you know, different types of food. What does it do for my body before exercise, during exercise, after exercise? And kind of the fundamental principle is that exercise burns blood sugar. That's, again, I'm certainly not a doctor or a scientist, so I have to kind of dumb it down for myself here. But as you burn that blood sugar, your body becomes, and as you exercise, your body becomes more insulin sensitive, meaning that you don't need as much insulin for the same plate of food that you would need if you hadn't exercised. So everybody with type 1 has their sort of ratios of how much insulin to X number of carbohydrates. And, you know, if I have, say, a sports drink or, you know, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, if I have that peanut butter and jelly sandwich sitting on the couch watching a movie, or if I have that same sandwich during exercise or after exercise or before exercise, the amount of insulin I need for all those scenarios might look a little bit different. And it might look a little bit different for each person. So the run across America we did, there was 10 of us all with type 1. It was a 24-hour relay. And we all had the fundamentals were all the same for managing type 1, but we all did it a little bit differently. Everybody's bodies reacted differently to insulin, to exercise. So it's not a, you know, there's no silver bullet. There's no one size fits all management kind of algorithm. It's a pretty complex, you know, the body, our bodies are capable of these amazing things. And you look at one organ, the pancreas, and just how intelligent it is. And we try to mimic what this organ does.
The guy that I mentioned that's, you know, that in my triathlon space in the UK, I coach him occasionally in swimming. And there's been a couple of instances when he's misjudged his insulin and started to almost zone out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite strange to be around somebody like that because, you know, he looks like he might look like he's drunk or he might look like he's just not focusing. And then all of a sudden he'll get these mood swings. What are the sort of things that have happened to you, Eric, when you've got it wrong, or when you haven't got it wrong, but you've misjudged what your insulin requirements are.
Yeah. And, you know, unfortunately it's easy to happen. It happens to all of us. You know, every day I'm continuing to improve and refine, and it's something that, you know, it's not going away. There's no cure, right? So we have to kind of continue to, always be improving and always be educated and always be learning. I did have a scary incident. So I was diagnosed in 2006. So it was about 2008. I was in the process of trying to get the device that I'm now on, that Dexcom. And I had played in a bunch of basketball games after work. And I didn't know the impact of exercise. I didn't know to think about, you know, 2 hours later, 4 hours later, the next day, depending upon how much exercise I took part in. You know, the longer you exercise, the more intense, the longer the impact on your blood sugars. And I didn't know that. So I went to bed after, you know, a couple hours of playing basketball with a work thing, and my blood sugar was good going to bed. I took a finger stick and it was a good number, but what I didn't have the mindset yet of thinking, where's my blood sugar headed? And in the middle of the night, my wife woke up to me having a seizure because my blood sugar had just continued to go lower and lower. And so, you know, fortunately we lived literally next door to the fire department. And so they were there quickly, and she was able to kind of try to get some sugar in my mouth, even though I was, you know, obviously passed out. But they were there within minutes, and yeah, everything's okay. Or at least the brain scan and everything seemed to be okay. But, you know, that's obviously, a reality that we live in. Hasn't happened since, because now I have this device where if my blood sugar goes low, it'll buzz to alert me. You know, I can feel it if I'm, you know, maybe 8 months ago or so, I was on a run. I was doing a tempo run, and I didn't have my device, my continuous glucose monitor with me. I think I was between insurances, or for some reason I had like a week or two where I wasn't on it. Which just, it killed me, because I went back to doing finger pokes, and I didn't have that same guidance. I didn't have that same confidence of being able to look at my phone and see where my blood sugars were headed. And so I'm in the middle of a run, keeping a nice steady threshold pace. And all of a sudden I just got, it's like someone just hit me. I just, all my energy zapped out. And I knew immediately that my blood sugar was low, and I was, you know, a little bit delayed on taking a gel. And, so I went from, you know, this 6.5 minute pace kind of cruising along to walking, knowing exactly why I was walking, because I just had misjudged when I, you know, how, when I needed to take on carbs. And then 15 minutes later, I was kind of right back at it. So it was very much avoidable, but that's kind of what happens, you know, when you talked about that feeling of, or that appearance of almost appearing to be drunk, or, you know, you can't put a sentence together. You know, someone says, what's one plus one? You kind of just, you know, the answer, but it just doesn't all come together. It can be really frustrating. There's shirts that people with type 1 have that says, you know, sorry for what I said when I was low or when I was high. And, you know, when you're low blood sugar, you don't have energy. You can start to sweat and you don't make sense. High blood sugar, you can get really lethargic and your energy is all zapped out. So it's really a balancing act of kind of trying to stay in that sweet spot and where obviously our bodies are functioning the best.
Yes, I've got a couple of questions, but my first observation of that is for those people who don't have diabetes, it's a bit like hitting the wall, really, isn't it? You suddenly feel like somebody's pulled the pin and everything's drained out of you. And like you mentioned there about going from a nice running pace to just a sort of like a walk within the space of a few minutes. So the first question I had there, Eric, then is, I mean, you talked about having a peanut butter and jelly or a jam sandwich, as we might say in the UK. Are there any foods that you have to avoid or that you have to eat more of? Or because you take insulin and you can monitor your blood sugar, you can pretty much eat a normal diet?
That's right. You know, everybody has their own sort of unique and individual outlook on their nutrition plan. I'm not a nutritionist, so I don't give nutrition advice. But for me, I took that same mindset that I did early on. I look at it as what is, you know, name a triathlete, right? Craig Alexander. What is whomever? What is the best athletes in the world? What do they need for their bodies to function the best possible? And sort of fire on all cylinders. How do I take that nutrition plan and make my type 1 management fit that, as opposed to saying, okay, I have type 1, so I can't have this or that. And the same thing goes for sort of during exercise or not. You know, if I'm at a, you know, we have our daughter's birthday party this weekend and, you know, I'll have a piece of cake, because as long as I know my numbers and I know for X amount of carbs, I need this amount of insulin, I could have 2 pieces of cake. I could have 3 pieces, but it's just the more sugar, the more carbs you add on, the more insulin you need. And insulin isn't necessarily a bad thing, right? Your body produces it and releases it as it needs. It's just the danger comes, the more that you add, the more precise that calculation has to be, because you have that danger of if you add too much, your blood sugar goes too low, and that's when you have a dangerous situation. But it is very much kind of like hitting the wall, like you said. You know, there's moments where I'll be in a workout and you know, not really sure if my blood sugar is low or if I've hit the wall just because I'm not that fit. So it's usually the fitness.
You mentioned intensity of exercise there and using glycogen, but there's a popular culture now among endurance athletes. I'm not sure if you've heard of or aware of Phil Maffetone, but he has this idea that if you take your MAF heart rate, max aerobic function, it is 180 minus your age, you can work out at a level which is predominantly burning fat. Is that something you've tried? And if you have tried it, is it something that's compatible with the with diabetes and might be adopted by diabetic athletes?
Yeah, you know, I've heard variations of that, I think. I'm not familiar with his exact work, but it sounds really interesting. I haven't went down that path yet. I've studied it. I've looked at it. My nutrition now is pretty dialed in. My, you know, I kind of BMI and blood pressure and, you know, kind of my, from a health perspective and my A1C, which is, kind of the golden, you know, kind of our golden number for, those of us with type 1, every 3 months we get a reading of what our blood sugar looks like. And my A1C is in a good spot where my doctor's happy. So it's kind of a, you know, if it's not broke, don't fix it.
Okay.
But there's that thought out there, right? If you don't eat any carbohydrates, then you don't necessarily need all of that insulin, right? Your body releases some insulin all day long. So our bodies need some insulin, but if you cut out carbs, then you, some people have success in that. I don't follow that rule, but again, there's nothing to say that doesn't work for other people with type 1.
My immediate thought on that is it's challenging enough dealing with just measuring your insulin all the time, then having to be mindful enough to organize your eating, to to have a low carbohydrate diet just adds in another layer of complication that you could probably do without, particularly if you're trying to train as well. It's just making your whole life even more difficult.
Yeah, you know, type 1 makes things challenging enough as it is. And so, I'm lucky. My wife has a very clean and healthy diet, and you know, we have a try to eat as healthy as possible here. Like I said, I do have a sweet tooth, so that'll tend to get in the way a bit here and there. But you know, it's for me the lifestyle of being able to kind of go out and eat. I kind of eat as I want and as I need in a healthy span. But I also know, from a training and racing perspective, I have dialed in, and this took, you know, a long time to get to this point, but I know that I need about 55 grams of carbohydrates every hour at, say, marathon effort. And at that rate, and that's usually, you know, a gel and a sports drink, and sort of that combination at that cadence keeps my blood sugar steady at that effort level. Now there's some insulin reductions that go into play kind of the day before and whatnot, but it's a balancing act. I think of it as, you know, as we're burning off the sugar, how much do I need to put back in to keep my blood sugar steady? And at that rate, I don't need to inject insulin during a race, which is nice.
Just before I move on, Eric, you mentioned the Dexcom machine that you have and the fact that it replaces sort of several hundred finger pricks per day. It just made me think. I've done the little thumb pricks and the finger pricks and the, you know, the ones in the earlobe when I've had fitness tests and they've been taking my blood to measure lactate levels and blood glucose. And if you're doing a 2-hour test and they're taking these samples from your thumb end every 10 or 15 minutes, the next day you're left with a really sore thumb. and the sports scientist always pays to try and use your non-dominant hand, so it's not going to affect your ability to grip things. But it just occurred to me that if you're taking that many pinpricks each day, before these constant monitoring machines were available, how do you stop your hands getting sore? Because if you go to the thumb, there's only so many pinpricks you can have before your thumb gets swollen. So you have to move on to the next finger. Yeah. You're pretty much got to go through all of your fingers every day. And after a while, the finger ends just become, you know, unbearably sore.
Yeah. You know, it's looking at my fingers now, and they're very happy because, you know, I, with this new Dexcom system, you don't need to prick your fingers. So, you know, I've been on this new version of it for maybe 5 or 6 months now, and I have hardly pricked my fingers ever during that time. Because once you put the system on, it takes 2 hours to kind of warm up and calculate. So during that 2-hour span, depending upon what my blood sugar looked like kind of going into that warm up period from the previous sensor, then I might check kind of halfway through. But once the system's on, after that 2-hour warm-up period, it goes for 10 days. So during that 10 days, I don't prick my finger one time because the device the technology now it's so intelligent that it has been FDA approved to replace doing a finger stick. So the days of 10 or 15 finger sticks and, you know, your fingers just look like they're, you know, been through a war. Those days are gone.
What we'll do, Eric, at the end, I mean, I'm sure that a lot of the diabetics who might be listening to this are probably already aware of this machinery, but for those who aren't, we'll put a link to the constant glucose monitoring equipment. I think Dexcom is actually available in the UK now, although I'm not sure if it's available on a prescription thing or private, but anyway, we'll link to that at the end of the show, because I know you're very vocal about the valuable support and help that's given you. Let's move on to some of your athletic pursuits then, because the top of your website, it's got your name, and there's a lovely picture of you running along this road above the city there, and it says overcoming obstacles to inspire, and then there's a little bit on the next bit about how sports taught you invaluable lessons about teamwork and dedication and all of that stuff, and then there's this list of those athletic accomplishments that you've had. And I want to leave the World Marathon Challenge to last, but a lot of the people who'll be listening are triathletes. So, and triathletes in general, without having diabetes, have a challenge on race day of getting the right food into their body, dealing with the upset stomach that comes if you're taking too many carbohydrates. So, what additional challenges do you have in the days before an Ironman and during the race and in the days after? Because in just in the way that you know you you're smashing your body and the fact that it's going to protest a little bit.
Yeah, it's gosh, you know, in addition to right. So my swim training is usually my blood sugars are wonderful during it. You know, it's a nice steady line. I don't have any spikes up and down. I get in for an hour and what you can't really practice that happens on race day is the effect of adrenaline, and adrenaline will spike your blood sugar. So my first full Ironman, Ironman Arizona, I went into the water, and the Dexcom's not, it doesn't read while you're in the water. And, you know, obviously wasn't going to stop and look at my device while I'm swimming, but, went into the water with the good number, came out of the water an hour and 5 minutes later, or maybe an hour, 8 minutes. I got to get my times down here, but, came out of the water and my blood sugar, it was on the device. It maxed out at high, which means it was about 400, which is crazy, just scary. And, you know, should go to a hospital if it's at that range for more than, you know, an hour, you know, a couple hours, you should go to a hospital. But it had spiked just because of the adrenaline of, you know, my first race and all the buildup and being, you know, at the start line and in that first hour. And so, as you said, nutrition is such a instrumental part of doing in a 140.6, right? And so my nutrition plan was kind of out the window immediately because I couldn't take on any more carbs until I brought my blood sugar down to a safe level. So it was you know, the first hour of the bike ride, I was playing it very safe from a health perspective, just trying to, you know, take on water. I gave myself a shot of insulin to bring my blood sugar down, and then finally was able to get, you know, back into a healthy range. But, there's other factors like that we don't even, you know, kind of think about, that from a type 1 perspective, be something like the effect of adrenaline. But, you know, and early, my first triathlon was a 70.3. And I didn't know what the heck I was doing. it was very much a trial and error from a athletic perspective, you know, I didn't know anything about pacing. I was a soccer player, so I didn't know, endurance sports were very, very new to me. And so it was kind of, my boss bought me the race entry as a wedding present. And so, I kind of jumped in the deep end a bit there, but really fell in love with the sport and just the endurance sporting world as a whole. I think it's a wonderful community. It's a healthy lifestyle. Enjoy being outside and going for a ride or going for a run or whatnot. And, so it's been a fun sort of transition going from those soccer playing days to endurance sports, because I think it gives us great opportunities to push ourselves and, you know, discover what we're capable of.
You talked about giving yourself an insulin shot during the race there. How do you do that when you're actually riding your bike?
So some people wear insulin pumps. You've probably seen people with pumps on, you know, it looks like kind of a little pager device, and it's got a tube that hooks into your body. There's an insulin pump out there that's wireless. So it's like a little pod that goes on your body, so you don't have the tubes. I've kind of used everything and anything over the past 13 years. For the past number of years, I've used pens. So it's sort of, it's a pre-filled, holds about 2 to 3 weeks worth of insulin. So it's, instead of using a vial, it's kind of a pen, looks like an EpiPen almost, that I can dial up, you know, however much insulin I want. And then I inject that pen needle into my body and push the end of the pen and it injects it in. So that's sort of the mechanics of it. You know, obviously on the bike, it takes a bit of balance to be able to inject while riding and sticking the needle in your body. So that's where having that ratio of carbs per hour, and when to take it on can really come in handy. Cause, you know, ideally during a marathon, during an Ironman, I don't need to inject insulin because those carbs that I'm taking on are being put to use essentially, right? And so the body's burning off that sugar as I'm putting it in. So I don't need to inject, but for that first Ironman where I was really high, I was in the transition tent for quite some time trying to get my arms around my blood sugar number there.
Do you, I mean, endurance athletes are particularly sensitive to needles and all of the, you know, the sort of stuff that surrounds that and the hysteria and TUEs and everything. Do you have to notify the race authorities, you know, the beforehand of your condition so that, you know, if questions are asked, if another competitor sees you with your EpiPen and, you know, it's not obvious, as you said, it's not an obvious disease having diabetes. So, and I guess you don't always wear a shirt that says, I'm diabetic, don't worry about the needles. But do you find yourself having to answer questions or letting people know in advance to avoid suspicion?
I always have, and I, you know, found after, you know, a handful of races that people are starting to become more familiar with type one. And so, you know, I've never, knock on wood, I've never had any problems with it, any issues with it. You know, I don't have a certified card from, or like a doctor's note that says, you know, I have type one. Well, I take that back. Actually, I do have some from my doctor, but it's, you know, you stick a needle in your stomach or in your leg or wherever around a bunch of endurance athletes and you get a couple sideways looks. But, I sometimes do it on purpose for that reason, because I think it drives that conversation, right? And there's so many people that I'll talk to anybody about type one, because I would say 80% of the time, and I talk to people every day about it around the world, they don't know that there's type one and type two. People look at me and they say, oh, when they hear when I say I have type one diabetes, they're like, well, you're too thin to have diabetes. You can't have that. Right. And so there's such kind of a level of education out there that needs to be had. So I try to do whatever I can to raise awareness, provide, like I said, you know, that inspiration, the education to whether it's somebody who has type one or not, because I think everybody can benefit from learning, you know, what it actually is.
We talked about my friend earlier. I just wanted to return to that incident where he sort of started zoning out, and one of the other guys in the pool had noticed that he was not quite himself. Knowing that he suffers from type 1 diabetes, I was able to keep an eye on him. But again, in terms of making people aware, when you go to sessions with coaches, particularly if you're somewhere where you've not been before, do you make them aware of your condition beforehand and perhaps let them know where that pen is, and or if, you know, what signs and symptoms to look out for, so that if you do start to go into that state, they can respond and make sure you're safe. And
like I said, I tell everybody about it. I'll tell the cashier clerk at the grocery store if they'll be willing to listen. But you know, when I went to our new master swim, I, you know, told the coach about it and said, you know, I've got a bottle of a sports drink here that has a bunch of, you know, carbohydrates in it, and I've got a bottle of water. Hope that's okay. You know, I've got a gel here, and kind of explained that, you know, if I start to not make sense, or if I'm, slowing down or slurring my speech, or, you know, kind of what those signs might look like. And, you know, if my blood sugar goes too high, I might have to pop out and take a shot, or I might have to run to the bathroom. And, people are wonderful by nature, right? They want to help. And I think, especially coaches, you know, I think, coaches are just great sort of people builders. And so I think that I've yet to run across a coach who, has seen it be a problem. I think, you know, I've unfortunately had to step in. I'm pretty easygoing person, but, I've had to step in where I've seen elementary or high school coaches or even college coaches tell families and kids that, you know, their child, or that they couldn't play on the team, whatever the sport was, because of type one, which I think is just absolutely ludicrous.
Whoa.
And so again, it's that bit of that lack of education, or just sort of being naive and not understanding what it means or what it doesn't mean. And, you know, then I tell them, you know, here's 30 athletes that have accomplished probably more than you have in your life. So there's no reason that this kid can't do this or that. Right. And so yeah, there's still a bit of education that needs to go on, you know, especially here in America, because people seem to, there's, you know, 28, 29 million people with type 2 diabetes here in America. And so the numbers are pretty, pretty drastic, but, more people hear the word diabetes and just kind of associate it with type 2, just because the numbers are so big.
Ah, okay. Well, we've had this thing there. I put it on the back burner, Eric, but I can contain my excitement no longer. I really want to talk to you about this World Marathon Challenge. So let's set the scene. In fact, I think that this race and this whole series was won by a British female, recently.
Just a phenomenal athlete, wonderful person. And in this small world of things, right, somebody close to her has type one. And she was an absolute competitor, and it was really fun to watch the women's side of the race. There were really three kind of dominant females: Denmark, British, and France. And all three of them, wonderful people, true competitors. And it was fun to watch them battle it out, because they had the women's race was much closer than the men's race. We'll just say that. But she was impressive day after day, and had a great 7 days.
I think looking at her time, she would have been third overall. Is that right?
That sounds right. Just thinking about kind of who placed where every day. That sounds about right. Yeah.
When I look at her results, her total time was 24 hours. The first man was 20 hours and 49. The second man, who's a well-known, I know him actually. I didn't realize that he'd run it. Peter Babrasek. Well-known international triathlete who competed at Kona many, many times as a pro. He was second in 22:58, and then the third male was Anna Van Treese, 25 hours. So Susanna Gill from Great Britain was the first female competitor home, and looked like she placed third overall. So fantastic. So let's talk about this event. It's seven marathons in 7 days. So that in itself is an amazing feat, but the challenge now is that after completing the first marathon, you then have to get on a plane and you have to travel to another continent. So for those people who aren't so clear on their geography, Antarctica, Africa, Australia, Asia, Europe, South America, North America. You have to go to each of those continents, and on the next day, you have to run 26 miles. And then whereas most of us would then want to go and put our feet up and get into bed and have a nice sleep, you've got to get on board a plane and you've got to fly to another continent. So you're traveling for a lot of time in between. Then you've got to get off that plane and you've got to run another marathon. So that is a huge number of logistical challenges there that I like to chat about. So this, and my only experience of this is reading the book with Ranulf Fiennes and Mike Stroud, who used to pair up to walk across the Antarctic and the Arctic. Pulling a sled, they did this, and I think Mike Stroud had all sorts of medical problems just to do with the flying and the damage to his muscles. So, firstly, the challenge of running seven marathons in 7 days. Then, I mean, that's that's enough in itself. How do you train?
Good question.
For an event
if I figure
like
it out, I'll let you know. I wanted to pick something twofold that hadn't been done by anybody in the diabetes community yet, and there's been such amazing accomplishments out there that it was tough to find something. You know, we've climbed Everest, we've ran across countries, we've qualified for, you know, world championships. And so there was this struggle to find something, which is a blessing, but it was also kind of, you know, banging my head against the wall. So I found this, and I, you know, prior to this, I had done 3 marathons, you know, a couple Ironmans, but certainly nothing, you know, kind of 7 marathons in a row. It was definitely outside of my realm of kind of understanding or comfort, but I wanted to show that if I could do this, any kid, adult, family member, doctor, whatever in the diabetes world, that they could have confidence knowing that as I was able to accomplish this, they can go do T-ball or swimming or ballet or soccer, whatever it is that they want to do. I wanted to give them that comfort and confidence to be able to say that, you know, there's nothing holding them back from achieving their goals as well. So it was a pretty big question mark for me. I mean, I had talked to Mike Wardian, world-class runner, right? And just all around, just a really great guy. And you see his times there. I mean, his average marathon time was 2:58. He went on to run 3 more marathons and set the world record for 10 marathons in 10 days. So just an absolute, just incredible athlete. But I had connected with him, you know, the year prior and kind of talked through what training might look like. And he gave me some tips, but it was really, you know, getting runs in during the week, but those long runs on the weekend for me was, you know, I think it peaked at about 30 miles Saturday, followed by 20 miles Sunday. So sort of that back-to-back long runs, running on tired legs, but for pretty significant distance. And, you know, I probably could have trained better, probably could have done more, but, you know, with a full-time traveling sales job and running the nonprofit and our 2 little ones, and, you know, it was kind of what I was able to do. And I got through training without injury, which is obviously a big hurdle in itself, kind of being able to build up the mileage. And I went in not really sure of, you know, everybody was asking, what are your times going to be? How fast do you think you'll run them? And I really didn't know. Even my wife, you know, at home, she'd be like, what do you think you're going to run these in? I'm like, I don't know. I, you know, I can tell you what my Garmin says I'll run 1 marathon in, but back to back, I've never done 2 back to back. So 3 or 4 or 5 or 6, 7, I really didn't know. So kind of took it, you know, one step at a time. And you know, it was every day was a new challenge and sort of this unknown, what was going to happen to my body, what was going to happen on the diabetes front. You know, continued exercise like this has an even more significant impact on blood sugar numbers and insulin need. And since something like this hadn't been done, that was sort of the biggest question mark, was what is type 1 management going to look like with a 7-day, 183 mile running event?
I mean, I'm looking at your times here. Your average time was 4:03 per marathon, right? But your fastest marathon was actually your last one. Is that right? Was North America, are they in the order of the results? So Antarctica was first and North America was last. So you ran significantly faster on the last day there than you did in any of the others. So clearly you got a second wind, or, you know, you knew that the end was in sight. But I mean, I worked with some guys who did one of those rowing challenges from Europe to the Caribbean. There was 4 of them. They weren't rowers from a rowing club or had any pedigree in rowing, but they were just 4 guys, and they were rowing 2 hours every morning, 2 hours every night on an indoor trainer, and then rowing the boat at weekends. And I asked them afterwards how the training had helped them get fit. And one of the guys who I'd worked with mostly said, you know what, Simon, when you've been rowing for 24 hours, you're seasick, you haven't slept, you've got blisters on your hands, on your legs and on your butt. And you're miles from shore, and you know you've got another 50 days to go. Fitness goes out the window, and it's down to mindset and the belief. And I guess the same thing is is true of this is there's a lot of opportunities to quit just from flying. You know, if you've got to fly for 8 hours and get off the plane and you haven't really slept and then you've got to run another marathon, I guess the incentive to quit is very, very high.
And it's funny you put it that way, because that's actually something I talked to the diabetes community about, is this idea of sort of, you know, anti-quit. And you're exactly right. And endurance events in general are, mental strength is a huge part of it. And so that was something that as I was prepping for it, I tried my best to kind of educate myself and do whatever I could from a mental strengthening perspective. Cause I knew that the fitness is important. Obviously the physical side of the World Marathon Challenge is pretty extreme. But that mental side of it is going to be as important, if not more important. And those of us with type 1, we every day we deal with something that is incredibly challenging, incredibly, you know, scary and demanding, and every day we don't have the option to quit. If we quit, we die. And so every day we harden, we sort of, you know, that you know, iron in the fire, you know, kind of getting stronger and stronger every day without even really realizing it. And so that sort of mentality, I saw that mental strengthening that we do every day kind of just in our innate behavior because of what we have to do. And so I see that as an advantage for us with type 1 or for anybody overcoming any obstacle, right? If you go through life and sort of have to overcome these obstacles on a regular basis, I don't care who you are, you're getting mentally stronger. And so I took a lot of that to heart and kind of carried that with me. And so, you know, during the, you know, these, some of these darker, lower points of the 7 day journey, I really tried to tap into that as much as possible. And it got me through and, you know, knowing that there was, you know, I've talked about kind of this diabetes army behind me. I mean, we'd get off the plane and get to some cell service because there wasn't Wi-Fi on the plane. We'd get to our phones and see, you know, this download of texts or social media notes or messages. And really it was pretty inspiring because I would get to read all these really quickly and just, you know, be kind of filled with inspiration from, you know, thousands and thousands of people around the world that really helped. And, I don't think I could have kind of done it without, but I also didn't ever doubt that I would be able to do it, not from a cocky or arrogant standpoint, but knowing the reason why I was doing this, it was so much bigger than me and just me doing an athletic event, right? It was the millions of people that have this disease with me, kind of along the journey with me. So I never really doubted I would finish. I might, you know, end up crawling, but I was certainly gonna make my way through it.
Let's just talk about some of the logistics then. So the first marathon was in Antarctic. So what were the travel challenges then getting from the Antarctic to your next race, which was in Africa? How long was the flying? You know, did you have a plane right there at the end of the marathon, or did you have to get in some vehicle to take you to the plane? And then how far did you have to travel from the airport in Africa? Where did you run? What was it like running in minus sub-zero conditions and going to Africa and running in you know, 20, 30 degrees?
Antarctica to Africa was definitely the most extreme change. Antarctica, and I myself, Celsius to Fahrenheit, I started getting better during the race, but so you'll have to forgive me here, but it was in the low teens for Fahrenheit. So it wasn't, you know, as cold as Antarctica gets. It was summertime. But with the wind chill, they told us that it got down to well into the negatives, kind of negative 10 to negative 20, somewhere in there. So it did get to be quite cold in Antarctica. The rate
was that far, negative 10 to negative 10 to negative 20 Fahrenheit.
Mm-hmm. So,
okay. I'll do the changes in the show notes. So, just you give me your figures. I know that in the US you use Fahrenheit written. We tend to use Celsius, but I'll tell you your calculations.
The track, the race course in Antarctica was essentially a kind of an oversized track that went around the runway. So, I posted a picture on my Instagram page. You can see the plane. Literally, we ran by it. So we would get off the plane in Antarctica. They would get the course, and this is sort of how it was for each race. We'd get off the plane for everywhere but Antarctica. We would get our bags, go through customs, get on a bus, drive to the race location. They would, which was maybe, you know, 30 minutes to an hour, kind of depending upon the city. And then they would set up the course while we sort of, you know, got dressed and got ready. So we might have about an hour or so from the time we got to the race location to when we started. So, you know, an hour, maybe hour and a half of kind of just nervous energy, getting ready for the next race. And then we do the race. And obviously, you know, Mike was coming in about, you know, under 3 hours, and the slower people were, you know, around the 8 hour mark. And so, we had up to 8 hours to finish. And so, you know, depending upon where you finished, you obviously had more rest time or less. And then once the last person was done, we would get back on the bus, go back to the airport, check our bags, go through customs, get back on the plane. For Antarctica, it was about a 5.5 hour flight back to Cape Town. So we got through the Antarctica race. One person ended up getting hypothermia. So kind of once we had everybody taken care of, got back on the plane, 5.5 hour flight back. And then we immediately did that next race. So that those two races were within 24 hours of each other. So they were back to back, and South Africa was almost 100 degrees Fahrenheit.
Whoa. So that's minus in Celsius. Then we've gone from Antarctica, minus 10 Fahrenheit, minus 25 centigrade. And if it's 100 degrees Fahrenheit, we're looking at 38 degrees centigrade. So we've got a 63 degree centigrade temperature change there, as well as flying for 5 hours. And I don't know, was there much of a time zone change between Antarctica?
Yeah,
or did you just
fly
directly
straight up and down? So those were on the same time zone. And Cape Town, you know, beautiful city. We were supposed to run earlier in the morning. We ended up starting the race about just because the, you know, everything was always a little bit delayed. But so we ended up starting smack right in the middle of the day, I think noon or 1 o'clock. So right in the thick of the heat, running on those old, right along the water. So kind of old colonial stone. It was pretty hard under the foot. So that was a tough one. And that was, you know, kind of back to back. And then we had a 17.5 hour flight to Australia, to Perth, Australia. So that western side of Australia. We started that race, 11 o'clock at night or something like that. Kind of pretty late in the evening, 10, 11 o'clock. On a, you know, beautiful night, and which was a blessing because Australia was having a heat wave during that time. So, you know, had we ran during the middle of the day, it would have been a whole nother element of pain. But we did that one in the middle of the night. Then we flew to Dubai, which was,
do you mind if I just jump in there a sec, Eric? So the 5 hours of flying from Antarctica to Africa, did you get much sleep on the plane there, or you know, are you really trying to eat and stretch and help your body recover? Or are you really just, do you just really not know what you're doing at all?
Yeah, the flying back, so that flight was the shorter one. That was one of the shortest flights of the trip. And typically, you know, typically we don't love to have long airplane flights, but this was the one case where we sort of enjoyed those longer flights, because that's when we would sleep and eat and get to sort of recover. And people had everything from, you know, Normatec boots to compression to foam rollers to Compex machines, and so it was you know, that was sort of our recovery and downtime. But yeah.
And what, on the plane that you were on then, was that I guess that was the plane that you used to fly you all around the world. Was it like a traditional long haul plane, or did it have a lot of the seats removed? Was it mostly like flying in first class with flatbed sleeping, or Yeah, it was it was a
chartered plane, and so the plane stayed with us. We used one plane just from South Africa to Antarctica and back, but then from South Africa on, we were on the same plane for the next, five continents. But it was essentially each row had four seats, so two seats on each side, and it was kind of your traditional first class seat. So, you know, that oversized, nice, comfortable seat. It laid, almost all the way back. It wasn't a total flat bed seat. But it went, it reclined pretty far. Some people would be sprawled out on the floor and, just trying to get totally horizontal. But yeah, it was, whatever we could do to recover and get as much sleep as possible. It was certainly trying to make it work.
I remember I did the Marathon mm-hmm. de Sable, which is the 7-day run across the Sahara Desert. And the last day we had just a 10K sort of jog really across the sand dunes to finish. But we got straight onto coaches to take us back to the main town where we were staying for the night. And you couldn't really move around much. Everybody was sat down. 7 days of, I think we covered 250 kilometers in 7 days. Everyone was dehydrated. Everybody had legs that looked like elephants' legs when they got back. They were so swollen. It looked disgusting. And of course, on top of that, the blisters and, the smell and everything. Well, what were the other things that you started to notice that were affecting you over over the course of the 7 days in terms of the way your body deteriorated?
Yeah, I travel a good amount for my job and I typically don't swell all that much. But this time it was hitting, I think everybody, it was certainly hitting me. And so my ankles and feet and, I was wearing as much compression as possible and kind of trying to keep my feet up as much as possible. But, it was just, I was almost getting the better of me, but we would have, from the time we landed to the time the race started, there would be about 2 hours, maybe 3 hours, in Chile, we had a really long time because we had trouble getting through the airport there. But, so I was able to get some of that swelling down before each race, but it got to be pretty painful and just uncomfortable, from a swelling perspective. It was a lot of upset stomachs. I think, from a nutrition standpoint. And the races, the guys do a fantastic job with the race. It's really well put together. It's well organized. They've kind of have everything you need. I think that the airplane food can be tricky for some people. And we saw that happen a lot. There was one race where I, in Santiago, I couldn't eat anything. I had thrown up in the bathroom. I wasn't able to keep food down, which obviously from a race nutrition perspective makes it quite challenging. From a diabetes perspective, it makes it just dangerous. And so the only thing I was really able to do was I had two Cokes. So not Diet Coke, but regular Coke. I had one at the start and then one, about halfway through or so. Cause that's the only thing I was able to sort of stomach, which is weird because you usually a carbonated drink during a running event isn't a good combination either. But for me, that was one of the bigger ones was, just the nutrition side of things. And so I resorted to as much simple food and, trail mix and protein bars and sort of as plain food as possible so that I didn't have to. So I was able to kind of get through as best possible, but my feet somehow held up and, I've always used compressed board socks and compression, and that stuff was a lifesaver. We had some injuries here and there. The doc was always pretty busy taking care of one person or another. But I every day kind of surprised myself and being able to kind of get a mile or two into the marathon and legs loosened up a little bit and kind of enough to push on. And there was an instance in both Madrid, we ran on a Formula One racetrack, which had been closed. It was the middle of the night and, quite cold there as well. It was about 30 degrees Fahrenheit, so just around zero or maybe negative one Celsius. And so it was, you know, quite cold, middle of the night. And I the only thing, you know, there I was putting basically candy bars inside my gloves to so that they wouldn't freeze, and then kind of eat those throughout the race. But, you know, the team bonding too was something that really the group came together incredibly quickly and, you know, became a really tight knit group. And so a lot of support, you know, it was a lot of the courses were sort of out and back. So lots of high fives and pats on the back to keep everybody going.
What about your diabetes management then and your insulin management? Because I guess that your body gets used to having the injections that you need to at certain times of day, and your body's used to sleeping at certain times of day. But you must have gone through so many time zone changes. And, you know, you talked about some of the runs were during the middle of the day. Some of them were in the middle of the night. You know, you're flying, you're going across multiple time zone changes. So in terms of your body clock, knowing where it was and therefore hunger in relation to daylight and nighttime, it must have been all over the place. So how did you manage to stay on top? I mean, clearly you did manage to stay on top of it, but was this a challenge that you anticipated beforehand, or because it was so much of an unknown, did you just have to go along with
it? Yeah, there was a hour by hour. So for me, I take two different shots of insulin. I take one fast acting insulin that I take throughout the day. So I might take it, you know, inject 8, 10, 12, 15 times a day, depending upon what the day looks like from a food perspective. And then I take a second type of insulin. I take every day at the same time of the day. So I take it, you know, 9 o'clock here in California every night. And, you know, I can't really miss that shot, or otherwise I'll kind of be in trouble for the next 24 hours. And so what I did was I set a 24-hour timer on my phone. And so wherever I was in the world, that 24-hour timer would go off. And I would, so that might, you know, it might be in the middle of the day, it might be at nighttime, you know, and I would take, so I would take that long lasting basal insulin at that time. So I was able to stay pretty true to it. I think by the time we got back to the States, I was maybe an hour or two off, which wasn't that big of a deal. But, you know, we after a country or two or a continent or two, night and day and breakfast and dinner and time zones, it kind of all became one just blur. You know, we would kind of wake up and eat and race, and then eat and go back to sleep and sort of rinse and repeat.
Wow. What about the recovery afterwards? I mean, did you clearly, like for most people, there's a huge high when you complete an event that you've been building up to for such a long time. But as you said, you didn't night and day, breakfast and dinner time, your body was all over the place. You've run 7 marathons in 7 days. You've traveled around the world and back and probably gone to the moon and around a couple of times.
Yeah, how long did it take to get back to normal? Flying miles is what somebody told me. It took a couple, you know, a couple of days, but at the same time, I didn't, you know, we've got 2 little ones. And so, you know, they're about to be 6 and just turned 3. And so, you know, as excited as they were, and as proud as, you know, they were of me, it's still, you know, I still got to be dad, right? which is priority number 1 for me. So we got back on, the race finished Thursday. We came back Saturday, and my daughter and I had a father-daughter dance that night. So I kind of had to quickly be back on my toes, no pun intended. But the jet lag finally hit me a day or two later. Once we got back to California from Miami, Florida, the jet lag finally did catch up to me. So I was, you know, tired for a couple of days there, and you know, had a little bit of a hip issue, just kind of from all the overuse. But overall, I mean, somehow all my toenails are still on. So maybe I just didn't run hard enough or something, but, you know, my body held together pretty well. And yeah, I think that's as you well know, right? I think that's a testament to kind of putting in a bit of a decent training plan and going in as prepared as I could.
So yeah, Eric, the World Marathon, amazing race. I will post a link to this on the show notes, because I'm sure all the geeky triathletes will love to dive a bit deeper into those splits. And I don't think you should be too hard on yourself with those times and whether you could have gone faster. Running an average of 4.3 over 7 days with all those other challenges is pretty good. So personally, I'd be giving yourself a big pat on the back and a nice, probably a nice tub of ice cream to chow down for a while.
That's right. Yeah, definitely have put the weight back on, but I appreciate that. It was a fun, you know, it was a fun opportunity to push myself and to, you know, I think I was excited to have the opportunity, not just the opportunity to help redefine and continue to redefine what type 1 diabetes can look like. I think people in or outside of the diabetes community need to realize that even though we have this incurable disease, there's no limits to what we can achieve with successful management. And, you know, as long as we do our homework and kind of know what we need to do, use the tools that we have available to us, we can really thrive with this disease. And so I wanted to be an example of that and do something that was a bit outside the box that you know, a lot of people didn't even think was possible. So I was happy to prove them wrong. But yeah, my last time there was about more than half an hour faster than any other race. So I was obviously excited to be at the finish, and you know, I knew I didn't have anything the next day, so I could kind of let it go and push myself a bit more there than any of the other days.
I've noticed when I've done multi-day cycle events and challenges through the Alps and you know, the Pyrenees, that you start off okay. The middle few days you get a bit fatigued and you wake up wondering whether you've got what it takes to get through that day, but then you seem to ride yourself fit. And I guess the same could be said here, is that it looks like you ran yourself fit, and you got a second win there towards the end of those 7 days, which is obviously reflected in that time you talk about.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting too, because each of the 7 days, I mean, there was sort of a story in each one, you know. I mean, looking at Dubai, my time was 3:59:49, and I was, you know, I was cruising along, and if I hadn't changed anything, I probably would have come in, you know, just a bit above 4 hours. And, you know, whether I came in at 3:59 or 4:03 or whatever it was, you know, really doesn't matter to anybody. But for me, it was that opportunity within that race to not, you know, not, I wasn't thinking about Europe or South America or North America, but just sort of being in the moment, and with about 2 miles left, started calculating, okay, if I can, you know, drop the hammer here on these last couple loops, you know, I've got a chance to come in under the 4 hour mark. And so, yeah, it was little things like that just sort of kept me going and trying to be present in the moment to get through each one. But each, you know, all seven of them kind of had their own trials and tribulations and challenges, and they were each very unique in their own right.
You mentioned a couple of sentences back about, you know, continuing to prove people wrong and show what's possible when you have type 1 diabetes. Is that what was the impetus behind the diabetes sports project that you founded or co-founded, and what you continue to do now with these challenges on your resume?
Yeah, you know, I as cliche as it might sound, right, I really see my diagnosis as kind of an opportunity to make a difference in the lives of others, you know, affected by type 1. When I was diagnosed, I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know what it meant, what it didn't mean. I didn't have a role model I could look to. I didn't know who else was out there. And now, you know, through social media, right, people can follow along. And I was trying to share as much as I could during the journey. But it's really that being that resource, you know, and Diabetes Sports Project, it's been an honor to be a part of it and kind of help do whatever I can to use it as a tool to make it a positive impact, because we've got this group of tremendous type 1 athlete ambassadors around the globe
from, you know, a 10-year-old gymnast to a 60-year-old kind of healthcare executive who does half Ironmans to, you know, Sebastian who climbed Mount Everest, Fiona who won a stand-up paddleboarding world championship, you know, guys and girls that do Ironmans and Kona and ITU. We have ITU off-road world champion, ultra marathoners. I mean, just an incredible list of athletes that all have that same mindset of, you know, they're not in it for the money, they or kind of the fame of it. Like, they want to use their accomplishments as a way to have a positive impact and be active in the community. And so we put together, whether it be a 5K or a triathlon or whatever it is, marathon, bringing people in the diabetes community together. We help them train for events and then we'll go and do it together as a group, and create some community events around the race weekend. So it really becomes this empowering weekend, that has a lasting effect. Cause, you know, it's one thing to kind of help get, and I'm sure you've seen it, right? You kind of change people's lives and getting them, you might be getting them ready for, you know, one triathlon, but you really kind of help shape their lives and change their life for the better. And that's really what we try to do too, is give them the ability to lead a healthy and active life with type 1. And so it's a lot of fun to be a part of it. And yeah, it was an honor to kind of be one of the co-founders, and now it's thriving. You know, we've got over 100 athletes around the world.
Well, we'll put a link to the Diabetes Sports Project on the show notes as well, Eric, with all of the other things, including your website, where people can find out a little bit more about you and some of the other work you've done, and no doubt be able to follow the next set of challenges that you have coming up. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you today, and I really do appreciate you taking some time to share your stories, not just your event stories, but your life story as well. It is very inspirational, and you definitely are living up to that little slogan that you've got on the top of your website there, overcoming obstacles to inspire. So thank you for sharing that with myself and the listeners, and I'm sure that they've been inspired to listen to your story too.
Well, I really appreciate it, and yeah, it's always fun to, you know, I think we all have obstacles and challenges we face, right? And for me and the people that I kind of deal with the most, it's this disease, and, you know, unfortunately there's no cure for it. And so if we can make lives better and help people accomplish their goals, then that's what I'm aiming for here. So
fantastic. Well, listeners, I hope you were inspired by that story today and our guest who's been on the show today, Mr. Eric Tozer, all the way from the US of A, over there in California. Eric, as I said, is the co-founder of the Diabetes Sports Project. He's just run the World Marathon Challenge. I'll put all of this stuff on the show notes. So that was Eric Tozer. I'm Simon Ward of the Simon Ward, the triathloncoach.com. This podcast will be out as usual on a Wednesday, and we'll be following you with more amazing guests. But for now, from myself and Eric, enjoy the rest of your week, and we'll see you again soon. Bye for now.
That's a wrap for this week's episode. Thank you so much for listening to the conversation, and I hope you learned at least one thing. If this is the first time you've listened in, please go back and take a listen to some of our previous guests, and I can guarantee they will be just as good as the one you've just heard. If you've been a regular listener, then thank you for being a part of this journey with me so far. Finally, I'd like to take just a few seconds to tell you about my SWOT Inner Circle program. In the last few years, I spent an awful lot of time creating training programs and resources to help you train and race at whatever triathlon distance you choose, and for some of the events outside of triathlon like aquabike, duathlon and swim run events. As a SWOT member, you get access to all of these plans for 12 months of the year, and on top of that, we provide guidance on strength and conditioning, nutrition, plus a whole host of other supportive activities which help you to train, recover and race better. We also have a really friendly Facebook community. It's an exclusive Facebook page for SWOT members only, and there are over 150 of them already. If you join, you'll be able to get access to that page and you'll be able to ask for help, and our members are all too happy to provide guidance and advice based on their experiences. I'll also be there to help you find solutions to your training problems, and all you have to do is tag me in the Facebook page in one of your posts, or you can book a 15-minute phone call should you need one. If you'd like more information, or if you're ready to press the button and join the SWAT Inner Circle, just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she will send you all of the details. So that's all for this week. Hopefully I'll see you again next week, same time, same place, with a different guest.